is in downtown Champaign, and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering ground and whole bean coffee purchased from farmers using internationally recognized fair trade standards.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Just before we get going here, I would like to run very quickly down a list of school closings that we have this morning, all of them because of the heat. And here we go. St. Joe Ogden Grade and High Schools will dismiss at 1 this afternoon. Ogden Grade School and Prairie View Grade School will dismiss at 1:10. The Muhammad Seymour Schools will dismiss early in this schedule, on the schedule. Sangamon School at 1 o'clock. Lincoln Trail School and the high school, 1:15. The junior high, 1:30. And there will be no afternoon kindergarten and no pre-K today. Heritage School District 8, that's Homer Broadlands, will dismiss at 1:25. And in Danville, the following schools will dismiss early. East Park Elementary at 2:45. Northridge and Southview Middle Schools at 1:55. Danville High School, 1:25. East Park evening care classes at 2:45. Otherwise, all the schools will dismiss at the normal time. And all of that's because it's a little warmer than we expect this time of year. If we receive more information along these lines, of course, we'll pass it on to you throughout the day here on AM 580. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a journalist who has become well-known for writing about issues of poverty, welfare, and welfare reform. His name is Jason DeParle, and he is a senior writer at the New York Times. He's here visiting the campus to talk about these issues, and we'll give a talk in the MillerCom series this afternoon at 4 o'clock. This is at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. It is sponsored by the School of Social Work and other units on the campus. These events are always free and open to the public, and so anybody who is interested in attending can do that. We're also pleased to have him here with us in the program this morning so we can bring him to a much larger audience outside of Champaign-Urbana. He's the author of a book that was published a couple of years ago titled American Dream, Three Women, Ten Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. It's now available in paperback. It's published by Penguin, and we'll talk about some of what you will find in the book. As we talk, as always, questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask is people are brief, just so we can keep things moving along. But anybody who is interested in calling in, contributing their thoughts, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure.
One of the things that I wanted to do to start as a way of getting into the topic was to ask you to share whatever thoughts you have about Hurricane Katrina and the aftermath. And I ask because I know that before going to work for the Times, you lived in New Orleans and you worked for the paper there, the Times-Picayune, which, by the way, is still publishing online. And mm-hmm. if people are interested in reading some of the local coverage and reading stories there from the reporters who live and work in that city and you have internet access, you can go to their website and you can read the stories. And maybe just in a general sense, I don't know, what sort of stuff was going through your head when you saw the images and you read some of the coverage of this place where you had lived and worked as a reporter?
Well, anyone who's spent time in New Orleans retains a special place in his heart for the city. It's an American gem, and it's a place that stays with you long after you leave. So to see the utter devastation of any American city is it would be heartbreaking, but all the more so when it's a place that seems so irreplaceable as New Orleans. If you had asked me 3 weeks ago, could I imagine a story that would put the subject of race and class front and center in American life, on the front page of every newspaper, on the top of every broadcast, I would have said impossible. You know, it had disappeared for the last 5-6 years. For reasons that maybe to some extent are understandable with the threat of terrorism and the war. But it has just come back with a vengeance. So if there's one thing from my own particular perspective on the world that's stood out to me, it's how many people focused on that so quickly, on the disparate racial and class impact of the hurricane.
Yeah. It's something that I'm sure that we will be talking about for a long time. And there will be who knows how many commissions and studies, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that there will be people who will be writing about it for a long time. And already one of the consuming questions, or at least the questions that has consumed the chattering classes, is who's responsible where was the failure here in the response? And depending upon people's ideological orientation, you know, they're saying that the failure is everywhere from the president of the United States or the entire country on the one end to the local authorities and the mayor and the municipal government on the other end and everything in between. And I'm interested in your thoughts on that question, particularly on the way that the government in the city of New Orleans and perhaps then one step up of the state of Louisiana responded.
You're right. We'll be untangling that question for a long time, although I think it's fairly clear already that there was evident that there was failures at all three levels. The mayor didn't have a viable evacuation plan. There were no buses getting people out. The governor was extremely slow to work the system and call in outside help. And FEMA's breakdown has been obvious to anybody watching the TV. I think if you're a resident of New Orleans or a resident of Louisiana, the first two are of particular concern to you. But I think the federal response is the one that the rest of the country is going to be focusing on. I mean, you can say, yes, the city should have responded better, yes, the state should have responded better, but the federal government's response is one that affects all of us potentially because any of us could be in that situation. So I think that's where the bulk of the focus will go.
Yeah, I'm interested in what you think about the way that the story has been covered and particularly the way that the media has looked at the themes that you touched on when I just asked you for your first sort of general response, that is class and poverty. It seems that that's something right away that in a lot of the reporting was put right at front and center.
And I have to say I'm surprised. I mean, I'm somebody who's covered race and poverty in one form or another for two decades, and I would not have predicted that would be the thing that everyone would seize on them. I'm struggling a little bit to explain it. I'm wondering if maybe there's an undertow of guilt, maybe, or if that's a bit too strong. Some sense that there really hasn't been any era of shared sacrifice in American life lately. I think there's this. I think it crystallized some latent sense of. That American life had been particularly inequitable in the last few years, and this kind of brought it out in some very vivid fashion. There's something more playing into it, I think, than just this moment.
Yeah. Connecting that then to the subject of welfare reform, I wonder to what extent you think that, in fact, what has been called welfare reform contributed to moving the issue of poverty and welfare kind of off of the front page and off of the agenda of people in politics, because whether it was successful or not, I think some people pointed to it and said it was successful, and that then that led people to say, well, we took care of that problem, and they went on to something else, and that in fact, welfare reform helped to push the needs of poor families, particularly working poor. And it just pushed them off the agenda.
I think it did help push the subject of poverty out of public conversation in ways good and bad. That's not entirely bad. If you go back to the early 90s, go back 10, 15 years ago, welfare was an extremely divisive subject in American life, that subject of a lot of really ugly rhetoric, a lot of poor bashing, racial code, vituperative rhetoric. And the good part, I think, of Clinton's hope in signing the bill was that it would change the poverty conversation once people saw the poor as workers, not shirkers, as people contributing to American life. They'd be more sympathetic. They'd be more likely candidates for a strengthened safety net, for health care, for child care. That was a genuine hope he had. And I think it proved about half right. We removed the anger from the conversation about poverty, but we largely removed the subject of poverty altogether. I think, by and large, people decided, hey, the bill worked. It got people off of welfare. And the second part of the conversation, though, what can we do to make sure they make a living wage and that their families are on some upward trajectory, that got lost, in part because of the externality of the attacks of September 2001 and the focus on the war on terror. But I do think the tragedy in New Orleans has the potential of putting the social safety net back on the national agenda in a positive way.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the alternative would be that, as often happens with so many big stories, we become consumed with it for a while, and then something comes along to displace it, and we forget. It seems that people often have a pretty short memory, and the media often has a pretty short memory.
That's one potential, although this seems such a large story, I don't think we're likely to completely lose track of it. The other worrisome potential to me is that once people are displaced in communities across the country, in fact, including Champaign, you have the potential for some real race and class conflict ongoing. And you've also already seen some hints of sort of racial ugliness about it. There was a Baton Rouge congressman quoted in the papers over the weekend saying, "We've been trying to clean out public housing in New Orleans for decades, and now what we couldn't do, God has done." So the subject, I think, is going to be out there, whether it's out there in a way in which the victims of the storm continue to seem sympathetic as they have till now, or whether a backlash ensues. I think that's a big question.
Yeah. I saw that same quote in the newspaper.
Wasn't this person just astonishing?
Well, it was pretty stunning. Was this person named?
It was Representative Richard Baker of Baton.
So it was not just an unidentified member of Congress.
Identified member of Congress.
He did that on the record.
I'm not positive about this. As I recall, he was overheard saying it to a group of lobbyists. I think it was. And it was overheard and meant not to have been in public.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Jason DeParle. He's a senior writer at the New York Times. He lives in Washington, D.C., has worked for the Times for a while, and before that worked for the newspaper in New Orleans, the Times-Picayune, and has been writing for quite a long time now about issues of poverty and welfare reform. That's the subject of his book, American Dream. It's now out in paperback. It's published by Penguin. It's also the thing that he'll be talking about in a MillerCom talk this afternoon on the U of I campus. So again, and if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can hear him and hear on the program. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a caller here, someone in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
I had a comment. I had to challenge one of your early comments about state officials being slow to ask for help. If I remember, the governor of Louisiana did request assistance as early as Saturday, a state of emergency, and was quite adamant about needing assistance during and certainly after the hurricane. That was one comment. And the other, in terms of revealing sort of the endemic racism that this event has revealed, you probably noticed AP, I believe it was AP Wire, two photographs, both of people wading in the waters. And one of them was of a white woman, and it said that she'd found food. And the other one was of a black man, and he also had food under his arm. You could tell that it was sodas, and it said looter. I was wondering if you would care to comment about that.
On the first point, I did some reporting last week on the state emergency management system. There was a wire that went out from the National Sheriffs Association calling for sheriffs across the country to prepare to deploy as first responders down to Louisiana. But before they could do that, they had to have an official request out of Louisiana from Baton Rouge to their own state capital. Otherwise, the responders going down wouldn't be they wouldn't be subject to reimbursement by FEMA, and they also wouldn't be covered by liability protections. You know, you can't just have sheriffs driving in from across the country. There was a 48 to 72 hour delay, I believe, out of Baton Rouge to get that paperwork out to the other states. So that's one of what I suspect will be a number of examples where there were delays and foul ups in the state system as well. I think when you go through the three levels of federal, state, and local, you'll end up seeing bureaucratic fault at all three. As for your second, whether whites and blacks were perceived to be behaving in different fashions, I think that's actually true. There is probably some of that. Although, by and large, I think most of the victims of the storm have been portrayed to date as very sympathetic. Clearly, the looting has been part of the story, but I think by and large, people are being seen as victims rather than as outlaws.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's go to another caller here. This is someone in Chicago on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I think this example of racism that you have the story so confused. You're talking about the problems of systematic racism, the endemic racism in this country, and you keep confusing it with poverty. You have yet to talk about true poverty in this country, because if you talk about poverty, then we really need to look at the rural poverty and the fact that the people in the rural areas were attended to even later than the people in New Orleans. And I think that, to me, the fact that the racism of the news media is so strong, and that you always concentrate on urban poverty, but the real poverty in this country is the extensive rural poverty that affects all groups of people in this country, particularly poor whites, since they're the largest number. And to me, I find that very upsetting. And my second point is, President Bush declared a state of emergency on Saturday. The fact that the lesson from 9/11 was supposed to be that everything was centralized under Homeland Security, if he declared the state of emergency on Saturday, then there shouldn't have been waiting for the governor. Once the governor requested on Friday that a state of emergency be declared, and the president did it on Saturday, then if our centralizing everything under Homeland Security really worked, no one would have been waiting around for a request out of Baton Rouge. So it just showed the fact that 4 years and I don't know how many billions of dollars were wasted.
Well, in terms of the race story, we were talking about New Orleans, and New Orleans, 85% of the poor people in New Orleans are African American. So
you were also talking about poverty in general. And I don't know, when I joined the conversation, you were talking about welfare reform and poverty in general. And that's not just the story of New Orleans. That affects the entire country. And as I said before, it particularly affects the rural areas. And I really think that you need to look, and all of your comrades in the media really need to examine your own racism and the fact that you are ignoring the rural poverty, which mainly has a white face, when you talk about poverty. And I think that helps for people to be not to be sympathetic, because this country is still so racist and so prejudiced that it's very hard for them to relate to black, poor black people. And that also encourages them not to act on poverty.
Okay. Well, in fairness, I should say that I started out, I asked the question about New Orleans. That's why we started talking about New Orleans specifically. And I asked that because the guest had been a reporter there for the newspaper. But you can respond however you like to that.
Yeah, we were talking about when you talk about poverty in New Orleans, you are largely talking about African Americans. We were talking about poverty in New Orleans, which is where the hurricane hit.
I'm sure, as far as your other comments, I don't imagine that the guest would disagree.
Disagree with the
other things that she said. I mean, would you be substantially in agreement with the other comments that the caller made? About the nature of poverty or not?
That I'm not.
Well, I'll repeat.
I'll withhold judgment on that.
Okay. Well, you want to follow
your
up at
point,
all?
Point, and that is simply that the news media went through the 2004 election, and you allowed the politicians to talk about everything they were going to do for the middle class, and no one spoke about the working class or the poor. That wasn't even in the agenda in 2004. So we shouldn't be surprised that the poverty level in the United States has increased for the fourth year in a row, and what we saw and haven't seen in the rural areas that were also damaged. So I just feel that the media is woefully inadequate. Even people who write about poverty like to write in cold words about urban poverty, which is really a very racist way to portray it. And I'm not attacking you personally. I'm talking about your field, which you know even better than I do, and you know what I'm saying is true. And I think that there really is a need to stop living in la-la land, because I think that's what, I mean, I know why people no longer buy newspapers, because I feel that they're just so woefully inadequate in covering their true issues, and everything is spin, spin, spin.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the comment. You can respond to that however you like. Generally, I guess, what do you think about the idea that, broadly speaking, the media has done a really poor job in reporting on issues of poverty, of class, of race, and how all those things come together?
I'm not sure I entirely agree with that. The media is covers a large subsumes a lot of different different mediums within it. But my newspaper, the New York Times, last year did a 10-part series on class in America. 10 very long articles, very in depth, where reporters each had months and months and months with different people to portray the effects of class in America. In 1999 or 2000, the paper had done a similar thing with race in America. I think most large metropolitan newspapers spend a lot of time writing about race and class. Mm. Now, if you're talking about the glossy women's magazines, if that's your idea of media, you're going to get a different perception. But I think most big papers have continued to spend a lot of time on it.
We're almost at the midpoint here. Again, questions welcome. We'll continue to talk with Jason DeParl. He's a senior writer at the New York Times. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to make sure that we talk some about welfare reform, which has been something that occupied you as a journalist for quite a few years, and the book that I mentioned a couple times, American Dream, is one of the results. The welfare reform that President Clinton talked about when he was running, that then eventually came into being, rested on a couple of basic things. One was that it said that if you're going to receive benefits, you're going to be required to work, or at least made progress toward working. And the other was that there would be a time limit on how much you could receive in benefits. And eventually the clock would run out, and that would be that. That seemed to rest on this idea that that some people had, that people who were on welfare weren't working, they weren't interested in working, they wouldn't work unless you forced them to, and that somehow working was the key to upward mobility and success for them and for their children. You spent time with these three women and their kids, women who had moved from Chicago to Milwaukee, really just on the eve of welfare mm-hmm. reform, to the state that had been hailed as a great success, state mm-hmm. of Wisconsin. How well, as a general question, then maybe we get into some particulars, how well did it work? Did it do the thing that everybody said? Maybe not just one thing, the many things that everybody said that it was going to do.
It worked far better than I would ever have guessed as an employment program. It got people off the rolls and into jobs. The main character of the book is a woman named Angela Jobe. She had been on welfare for 12 years. She had no high school degree. She had four kids. She had few skills. She was exactly the kind of person that so many of us, including me, I would say, I'd add, thought wouldn't be unable to find jobs. You know, who's going to hire her? Who will take care of the kids? Where the job's going to come from? And within 6 months, she was off the rolls and on the job as a full-time steady worker. She now even has a 401k. So if I just told you that alone, you would say, my God, that's the best thing that's ever happened in a government program. It got lots and lots of women, just like Angie, off the rolls and into the work. On the other hand, here's the but. She remains poor. She lost her lights 3 times in 3 years. She lost her electricity. She went without health care. She ran short on food. She remained just as physically poor, materially poor, as she had been before. That's one disappointment. And I think maybe even the larger disappointment is it didn't do anything for her kids. It did not put her kids on an upward trajectory. Our real hope is this law would pay off in the kids buckling down in school, getting degrees, going on to better lives. It didn't change that at all. All it did was get her off of welfare into work. It left her poor, and it left her kids floundering as well. So whether or not that's a success depends on, is really a Rorschach. It depends on which of those things you think is most important.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly for people pointed at the numbers, the reduction in the numbers on the welfare rolls, people simply took that number and pointed to it and say, well, there's a success, right? We move people off welfare and they're working. It sounds as if there wasn't quite as much.
And that's not completely illegitimate.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, that's a marker. I don't think there is one marker of success. I think getting people off of welfare and into jobs is generally a good thing. Angie likes working. She's happier that she's off the rolls on the job. And you know, the taxpayers of Wisconsin should like it too. I mean, yeah, I don't want to denigrate that. That's a good starting point, but one would hope it would go beyond that eventually.
Yeah.
It hasn't to date.
And why? Just because the kind of jobs that are available, given
the
women's
low paying
experience, education, and so
her
forth.
Her wages, her earned income. She'd always worked a little bit off the books, so yeah. But her earned income went way up, and her welfare and food stamps went way down. And when you factor in taxes and factor in some work expenses, it's about a wash. So you could say, all right, well, at least, you know, she's on her own. She's off of welfare and she's working. She didn't fall backwards. There's some good news in that. She didn't fall backwards. She's now making it on her own. But for me, the part that really disappoints me is that her kids don't look to her as a role model and say, hey, that's what, you know, I want to do better than mom.
Mm-hmm.
They just sort of experience her as being gone more. Her oldest daughter got pregnant, dropped out of high school. Her two sons have now dropped out of high school too. It just didn't change the dynamic in the family.
And there was this expectation beforehand that would happen?
On the part of policymakers?
On the part of policymakers.
On the part of many, yes. Yeah. You know, when I was working on the book, if I just ran, and on the public too, the general public, you know, if I just ran into an old friend from high school and said, well, I'm writing a book about this woman who used to be on welfare, and the first thing they would say is, oh, I'll bet the kids are proud. I mean, it's a natural expectation. We all like, all of us who are working parents like to think our work conveys something to our kids, you know, that the kids take a moral object lesson away from us. It's a natural thing to hope for, but I have to say it's where what I saw on the ground most diverged from the policy conversation in Washington. Mm-hmm. That did not happen to Angie's kids. And the social science literature, I think, shows it's not happening to the population as a whole.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Jason DeParle. He's a senior writer for the New York Times. He is here visiting the campus. He's giving a talk in the MillerCom series. It's also sponsored by the School of Social Work to talk about some of what he has seen as he has reported on welfare reform over a number of years now. His talk is A Shot at the American Dream this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the U of I campus at the Levis Center. And it's free and open to the public. Anybody who's interested should stop by. Also, if you're interested in reading the book, it's out now in paperback. It's titled American Dream, Three Women, Ten Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. It's published by Penguin and has gotten a lot of positive reviews, a lot of positive attention. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We'll go back to the phones, talk with some more people who are listening here. Champagne is next, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Hi. Good morning. I was a welfare mom in the 80s. I was a single mom. I had my son. And I became a welfare mom because at that point in time in my life, I didn't really have an education. All I had was my high school. And the kind of jobs that I would get paid so little that being on welfare paid maybe a little bit less. But it allowed me to stay at home with my son because he was very young at that point in time. And having had experience of working at daycare centers and watching these working moms drop off their kids, very young children, into strange environments, unknown environments with unknown grown-ups and people, and how traumatic the experience had been for the mothers and the children, you know, I think that I decided that I wanted to be on welfare, but I was on welfare on and off throughout maybe a 10-year period. And it was very difficult even back then because there was, I mean, I would go to the grocery store and I'd be embarrassed to show my food stamps. And I even moved to the states where they paid more welfare. I was living in Colorado and then I found out that California paid better welfare. And so I moved to California so that I could improve my lifestyle with my son. And it was a struggle, but I mean, I think that something that isn't talked about that much anymore, which was I know that in the 80s, most of the folks in welfare were single women with children, where the the father figure was no longer present, and I get a sense that it's still like that now. And another thing that when welfare reform was being talked about, I was very upset because obviously I've been affected by it personally, with the fact that I just wondered, out of these people who were doing these policies on welfare reform, how many of these people were actually ex-welfare moms who had maybe at some point succeeded in raising their kids, and seeing what kind of advice policymakers could get from these women. I always feel that mothers and single women are like the invisible citizen in this country who's never really, you know, allowed or given the opportunity to express. And the fact that we're the ones that are raising the future workers, quote, and citizens of this country, we're really treated as second-class citizens, you know. And I've taught at community colleges in this area now, and I've come across, you know, young women who are trying to go to school and they have kids and they're on their own, and it's still really hard for them. And I just feel like this, our system, our country being like one of the richest countries in the world, penny picks when it comes to helping single women with kids. And we have all this thing about, you know, have your baby, no abortions. You know, so they want you to have your kid, but then you're not helped in providing the support and assistance economically. And it's mostly economically. I mean, if it was up to me, every single mother would have a vehicle and would have a decent income so that she could at some point, you know, do what she needs to do to get herself ahead in her child, you know. And I don't really think that the reform system or even the one before that really did that. They just penny-picked and just gave you just enough to survive. Mm-hmm. So well, I just, you know.
Yeah, I appreciate the comments. Let's see what
sure.
The guest has to say.
Two thoughts about that. The welfare system was originally created in order to help women stay home with their kids, to help poor women stay home with their kids, which is what other women were doing. The idea was to give the low-income mothers the opportunity to do the same thing that middle-class mothers were doing. Two things happened. I mean, that was the model in the 1930s and the 1940s. Most of those women were widows. The classic welfare recipient was a West Virginia coal miner's widow whose husband had been killed in the coal mines, and now he wanted to do something to allow her to stay home and raise the kids rather than having to go off to a mill or something and work. The two things that happened, I think, is that, number one, most middle-class women started to go to work, so that by the mid-1980s, the majority of women, mothers with preschoolers, were in the workforce. So now you had a system where you were paying, allowing poor women to stay home when it's increasingly less and less the norm as middle-class women are going to work. Even more than so, there's a inequity there, and middle-class women who are paying taxes are starting to resent it. Even more than that, I think there was a sense that the kids were not being raised in successful ways. I mean, if it sounds like the woman who just called in was a very devoted mother who took the time to really be with her kids. I think there was a perception and in many cases a reality that those kids were not growing up to do well in school and to go on and have successful lives, but were being damaged by being home with women who had lost focus and lost ambition. So the sense was, I think, by and large, that this was really bad for kids. Mm-hmm. And both of those things combined to produce the 1996 bill that, you know, this was supposed to be fair to other women who were going to work and was supposed to be better for the kids.
To what extent, particularly for the women that you got to know when you were writing the book, and more generally, do you think that lack of childcare is a big issue and a big problem?
Here I'm going to say something potentially controversial, much less than one would think from the policy conversation. Mm-hmm. In Washington in particular, and usually when we talk about this, that childcare is front and central, the policy issue. Yes, it's important. It's in one of the things some women need when they go to work. But it was never the crucial issue why the women I wrote about didn't work. They did have access to childcare. They had each other. They had informal networks. They used the formal childcare system much less often than I think women policymakers think. The reasons they weren't working had to do childcare was never the reason that they didn't go to work. It was it's an important part of the puzzle, but it's just not as central, I think. Mm-hmm. as it's made out to be in many policy conversations.
All right, let's go on. Let's take next caller, Champagne Line 2. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I started out when I got online to talk about something else, but I was really impressed with the young lady that called just prior to my getting on. I think she made a point that is very classic, and we tend to just ignore it. But it comes home to me. I mean, very conservative people and Republicans are always talking about anti-abortion. Well, you know, what happens when that child's born? Is there going to be a support system there for that child after it's born? And for me, I think that is the reason why I think men, I know we're Americans, but I think men's input on abortion or not, it should be very limited, because a lot of those women that have those babies, they can't have them without men, and lots of times they walk away from them. And I think I'm pro-choice, obviously, but I was really impressed with her. And one more comment, and I'll go on. I thought the lady previous that brought out the point, which I totally agree with, that, poverty is not only in urban settings. It is certainly in rural settings. But I think if we don't recognize that the delay of our government going into New Orleans and supporting those people initially wasn't a racial thing, then I think we're just putting our heads in the sand. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
On the abortion point, there's a one story that Angie told me, a story in the book that was most touching or gripping to me, involves her getting her decision not to get an abortion at a certain point. She had moved to Milwaukee. She had three kids. She was on her own. She had just struggled back on her feet. She'd gotten a job. She was working. She was pulling all together a new life in Milwaukee. And she discovers she's pregnant. She decides she just can't do it. She can't have a fourth baby. She has no way to support it. It's just not fair to the other kids. It's not fair to her. She summons her gumption. She gets up the money. She goes to an abortion clinic. It's surrounded by protesters. They're screaming, baby killer. Jesus doesn't want you to do this. She makes her way through the crowd. She gets in. She pays her money. She actually gets up on the table. And she decides she can't go through with it. And she gets down. She climbs off. She says she can't kill her baby. These are her words. I can't kill my baby. And goes home and has this fourth child that she really, really doesn't want and really, really can't afford. But her own code of morality came into play there. It was a moment that really captured me, because I think the society at large tend sometimes to view poor people as being expedient and being governed by immediate self-interest and gaming the system and doing having babies to get more money. Just here was such a clear example of this woman who really perceived this to be against her self-interest, but yet had this personal moral code that she felt she had to follow there. It was a brave decision on Angie's part, I think.
Yeah. I want to ask you to talk about something else, and it's a big piece of this puzzle that no one seems quite to know what to do about, and it becomes highly politicized, and that is what could be done to get the men, who are the fathers of these children, to be more involved with their mm-hmm. kids, and possibly go on to form stable families and to form a family.
It's incredibly important. If I learned one thing, if I came away from I followed Angie, Opal, and Jewel, the three women, for 7 years. And if I came away from from it with one message in mind. It was just the incredible importance of bringing the men back into the family lives in some productive way. Mm. You know, the subtitle of the book is Three Women, Ten Kids, and the Nation's Drive to End Welfare. You know, what's missing from their lives is what's missing from the subtitle. It's the men. They were really absent. I have to say, the men I met, I found them much more sympathetic than I would have expected. They were almost all selling drugs. They almost all had been in and out of prison. Most of them had kids by more than one woman. You know, I would get these descriptions before I would meet them, you know, from Angie, Opal, or Joel about their latest boyfriend. And, you know, if you got the sort of resume, so to speak, you would think these are not particularly sympathetic people. But when I would meet them, I'd experience them less as deadbeat dads than kind of wounded sons, guys who had been abandoned by their own fathers and had always said they wouldn't do the same, even as they were now doing the same. I sensed some potential, some desire to want to do better. So, strangely, I feel for all the terribly discouraging statistics that are out there about the employment prospects of inner city, particularly African American men, I feel some strange optimism just coming from my own time with them of this sense that they do want to do better by their kids and by their families.
Well, is there something that government can do?
I think so. To me, if you look, let's go back 20 years, right? At one point, we said, hey, how will we ever get millions of women like Angie off the rolls and into work? Who's going to hire them? What can they do? And the employment rates of weeks, we had several decades of experimentation, and then the employment rates of those women shot up by a magnitude we wouldn't have imagined possible. To me, that's a confidence-building measure, you know, to borrow a term from diplomacy. Mm-hmm. To me, that says if we could do it for the women, we can do it for the men. But I think we're several decades behind where we are with the women, and it's going to take a period of experimentation the way we have with women.
Well, what we've seen with the women is that while they are working, they're working at marginal jobs, maybe paying minimum wage or slightly above, and that it's certainly not a living wage. Is the thought, though, that if you had a man who had that same kind of job, manageable.
There was a natural experiment unfolded with Angie and Jewel, two of the women in the book. Angie poured her heart into her work, tried desperately to keep working her way up, and her cars kept breaking down. And she kept getting 10-cent an hour raises, and she, in the end, she's kind of burned out and felt disrespected, and she plateaued. Jewel worked just as much as Angie, made just as much, or as little, but really put her heart into a guy named Ken Thigpen, who was a drug dealer and pimp and went to jail. And as I'm watching this, you know, unfold over the years, I'm thinking, Jewel, don't do it. Jewel, this is a terrible mistake. I'm convinced the book is going to end with Ken getting out of prison and dropping her and going off to back to his drug life. Well, to my amazement, he gets out of prison, comes back home, and decides he's done with the drug deal, and he becomes a pizza delivery man. He's now been out of prison for 5 years, no new arrests. Yeah, he's got a dead-end entry-level job, but they have two incomes now. They're appreciably better off than Angie. They've had a baby. He's home to help raise the baby. The life feels palpably more hopeful in Jewel's household, and there's twice as much income in it. It made a huge difference.
Right. We got 5-6 minutes left. We have some other callers here. We'll continue to talk with our guest, Jason DeParle. He's a senior writer for the New York Times. We'll go next to a caller here, I believe, on line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes. Well, you've kind of focused mainly on black poverty, although I think the lady said that poverty is poverty. It cuts across the board. But a number of years ago, I took a college class. And, you know, there was kind of a dichotomy and black thinking of George Washington Carver pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, and then later Du Bois come along, and it was kind of more into activism. And, you know, as with most anything in life, you know, we tend to kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater when we make a shift in our thinking. And we see this in all facets of life. And there's always good things that can be retained from the past, and I think that perhaps that was something that the black community leadership could focus a little more on, is that, you know, keeping children in school, encouraging that, and being of encouragement to parents as long as supportive, too, because we see the government, it doesn't matter who it is, they're looking out for the greater picture and kind of their own self-interest and the individuals, well, then they kind of just fall through the cracks frequently, no matter what. And I think a good example of this is when Jesse Jackson came down to Decatur. Decatur had a phenomenal dropout rate, and he came down and did his thing. And, you know, if he had, along with that, said, we need to keep these kids in school, we need to have a long-term thing here, and I need to be encouragement to these kids to stay in school. But, you know, when his publicity was over, he left, and the dropout rate is still, well, not quite as bad as it was, it's still hideous, and the voters voted down a referendum that was badly needed there, too, is probably part of the fallout. Another thing that kind of goes along with this is when I was taking these college classes, there was a lady that I sat next to from Central Illinois, and her granddaughter was graduating from high school. Her parents had sent her from Southern California to live with her black grandparents, they were all black, in Central Illinois because, one, she was being ostracized in her school for excellence and for having family values, and also they wanted to keep her away from gangs and keep her from harm's way. And I thought that was a really sad commentary on life, that a family had to send their child halfway across the country for those reasons. Thank you.
All right. Well, you can reflect on that. Maybe it gets us back to the issue of what's happening with the kids and why it is that there was this expectation that somehow if moms went to work, that then there would be sort of the spirit of rising aspiration somehow, and that somehow there would be this connection between women going to work and children doing better in school and being more successful. And then hopefully the next generation would get a better leg up, and somehow the everybody was supposed to rise, and it just didn't happen.
Yeah, I think the mechanics of it weren't entirely clear. I think part of it was that the women would feel better about themselves. There'd be a new rhythm of discipline in the house. And that the kids would look at the mothers and see how hard they're working and think, hey, I don't want to have to do that. I want to do better. That was the theory. In practice, I think it just has largely meant that the mothers are gone more often. In Angie's case, her kids were absent in school more often after she went to work than when she was at home. I mean, I don't want to say things were great when she was home. There was a lot of chaos in the house, but their absentee rate rose from about 20% to 25% after she went to work. And you know what else happens is sometimes as the older kids become the caretakers of the younger kids when mom's away at work, and so you see the older kids missing more school. You have two problems with the older kids. One, they're less supervised, so there's more opportunities to get into trouble. And the second is they have to, in turn, supervise the younger kids, which means they often miss school.
Mm-hmm. Something else I think it's an important point is that there also was this idea that somehow the children would look at their mother and see their mother working, and that somehow that would be novel and inspirational. Well, in fact, did you found out that these women, the grown women who have the children, when they were kids,
yeah,
their
mothers were
worked.
Working. Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
That doesn't. So yeah. In that sense, there wasn't this. There
yeah,
wasn't
all
really
three. Opal,
change.
Angie, and Joel. Right. I thought the three women are cousins. All three of them grew up with working mothers in the house. What they didn't grow up with was fathers. Mm-hmm. That was the missing ingredient going back a number of generations.
And we'll see if we can quickly get one last call in the time remains. Line one here is Champagne. Hello.
Yes, this goes to the plight of people who've been driven off of the welfare rolls into low-paying jobs with no insurance, and I'd like to make a modest proposal that if we tie congressional salaries to a multiple of the minimum wage and also make members of Congress have the same kind of health care that people who are poor have, we would have a living wage in this country, minimum wage, and we'd have national health care yesterday.
That's a delightfully mischievous suggestion. I'd love to see the amendment offered on the House floor. It'd make for some interesting discussions. You know, there's been an effort in the Senate to raise the minimum wage. And the Republicans have kept it from coming to a floor vote through parliamentary measures, through parliamentary means. I think if it ever came to a vote, it would pass, and that's why it hasn't come to a vote.
A little earlier, I asked the question about child care and how much of a problem lack of access is. And you said, yes, it is a problem, but perhaps not as much as we might.
Not the problem,
What about health insurance and access to health care? is lack of it, is that a big problem?
I would say there were more people who stayed on welfare for the because they feared losing health insurance than there were people who stayed on welfare because they couldn't get child care. Yeah. Right. People stayed on – yes, there were a significant number of people who stayed on welfare in order to get – because if they left, they would lose the medical care. Mm-hmm.
We are just about at the point that we're going to have to finish because we've worked through our time. As a way of finishing up, would you say that you were optimistic given what you've seen?
I'm optimistic because – of the character of Angie and Jewel themselves, because you just can't spend the time I spent 7 years with Angie and Jewel without coming away with this sense that these are smart, capable, resilient people. You don't come away thinking, Josh, these are just people who are wards who have to be products of the state. There's all these poor people. We're just going to have to take care of them the rest of their lives. There's nothing they can do. You feel like these are people with a lot to contribute to life. And if we can continue to figure out how to unlock their potential, these are smart, capable people able to achieve. Mm. Life has conspired against them so far in a way that's kept them from doing it. But they have. I came away feeling, solidarity with him at that level. I did.
Our guest, Jason DeParle, he's a senior writer at the New York Times. His book is American Dream, 3 Women, 10 Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. It's now available in paperback, published by Penguin. He'll be talking on the U of I campus on this subject, A Shot at the American Dream, this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Center. It's part of the MillerCom series and sponsored in part by the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois. It's free, open to the public. Anybody interested in attending should feel welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of every size and color combination from new to antique to complement any decor. Eastern Rugs, 1402 South Neal in Champaign. Focus also made possible with support from the Art Mart and the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. At 11 o'clock this morning, we'll be going to Washington and National Public Radio for the beginning of the coverage of the hearings in the Senate for the nomination of Judge Roberts to be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So that'll take up much of the rest of this afternoon and the rest of this week. Right now, though, we'll get an update on the markets.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with an update of the markets. Before we take a look at the numbers, a quick reminder that we will try during the 2 o'clock hour this afternoon, during a lunch break of the hearing nominations for John G. Roberts, to bring you at least a portion of the closing market report live. We will have guests of Joe Persaki, chief of crops branch of the National Ag Statistics Service, and Daryl Good, agricultural economist at the U of I. Tentatively, we're scheduled to break away around 2:15, and we will join the closing market report live in progress just as soon as the hearings break for what is anticipated to be a lunch recess. Let's go ahead and get you caught up with the markets, though. September wheat now, 307.5.